Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 24th of January 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. A great pleasure to be with you today. For the next 2 hours, we will be going through some very important topics for Australia and the world. In the second hour, I have a guest coming aboard, Dr. Vera Scheibner, who has been on our show once before, who is an expert in the scandals over vaccines, and she has been studying this topic for several decades. Her house is a library of documents. She has been collecting medical reports, studies, and she has really done a lot of detailed analysis to confirm in a pretty rigorous way the assumptions that many of us are making about the ineffectiveness of vaccines, which are largely anecdotal and often subject to extreme ridicule by the media, by the press, because most of us who are skeptical of vaccines don't really have the medical or scientific expertise to back it up. But Dr. Scheibner does, and she has a number of scientific qualifications. She's not actually a medical doctor, but she certainly has a very strong grasp of the topic. Now, of course, she, like anyone who steps outside of the mainstream, has been vilified and ridiculed, but she is actually subjected to less criticism than some of the other more well-known high-profile vaccine campaigners. And partly, she says, that's because she has maintained a very, very clear position on it, and she's very adamant about her view, and she doesn't beat around the bush. She doesn't try to take a middle position. She is basically an anti-vaccine campaigner, and that is how she's happy to be described. So she's going to come on today. We're going to be talking about the whole scandal over Dr. Cherie Tenpenny, another highly qualified person, an osteopath, who had been scheduled to come to Australia to do a series of lectures, all of which have been cancelled due to basically a hate campaign against her, which has been put forth on the mainstream media at the behest of lobby groups and supported by the Australian Medical Association, with calls for her visa to be revoked. And I've talked about this quite a bit on the show. I was talking about it last week. It's an extremely important human rights issue, folks, as much as anything else. And it's incumbent on a show like this to really raise this topic to that level, to make people understand that this is an international scandal. This is a very serious breach of basic human rights. And you know, even the Australian Civil Liberties Union, which is actually pro-vaccine, has actually come forward in support of Dr. Tenpenny, simply on the platform of free speech. So we'll be getting into that in a lot of detail in the second hour. It's going to be a really interesting discussion. Now, in the first hour, I've got some important stuff to go through. And I want to take a look at two stories which really highlight the way in which our society has fallen into this cruel, compassionless mode that is not worthy of a civilized society. It's kind of a decline of morals and ethics, and you know, you see that exhibited most clearly in the way we deal with the most unfortunate and the most reviled members of society. You know, can people be dealt with respect? And my topic here is to look at the Bali Nine, the two men who are on death row currently in Bali, and I also want to look at the case of David Hicks, because there's been some new information come forward there. People who are thrown onto the scrap heap, people who are considered as worthless and very little care is shown about what happens to such people. Now, in the case of the Bali Nine, I'm certainly not questioning their guilt, and they haven't denied it either. But let's just face the reality that these people who are used in the drug trade as mules, even the ones who are like the organisers, like Andrew Chan, I believe, was the organiser of this group, are still very, very minor players. Anyone who actually carries drugs on their body is a mule. And they are people who are manipulated and used because of their vulnerabilities and the system of illegal drug trafficking depends on being able to find people like this in our society. The whole network of drug trafficking relies on very, very high prices, which are kept artificially high by things like the death penalty, by the extremely harsh penalties which are meted out to these pawns in the game, who only represent a tiny fraction of the amount of drugs that are actually coming into the country. But that will certainly keep the prices up. That will keep the prices high. It keeps the myth of artificial scarcity. Whereas, in fact, you know, industrial quantities are being imported into the country every year. And it's coming in on container ships. It's coming in large-scale imports. When you consider the amount of drugs that are actually sold on the streets, you have to realise that these trifling amounts that people are able to conceal on their bodies or in their body cavities cannot possibly be supplying that need. So these individuals are simply hung out to dry. They're just the patsies. I mean, they are effectively patsies. Not saying they're good people, not saying that they're not guilty, but they are so far removed from the real culprits. I mean, I for one don't support the laws against our drugs. I don't use drugs either. I drink a bit of alcohol. I drink beer and wine. I don't get into any other substances. I'm actually, you know, quite concerned about my health. I really don't need or want to experiment with drugs. I've done it a bit when I was younger, long ago. For me, health is the most important thing. But I want to just focus on the question of compassion here. And there is a very, very important reason why I'm saying that. The drug bust of the Bali Nine came about as a result of the father of Scott Rush, Lee Rush, who called his friend a lawyer concerned that his son may be going overseas to do something wrong. It actually came as a result of the tip-off of the father of Scott Rush. And I've got a story here from the ABC. AFP's role in case a gross error should be cited when pleading for Andrew Chan and Miran Sugerman's lives, lawyer says. Brisbane lawyer Robert Myers said the Abbott government should cite the role played by the Australian Federal Police in providing intelligence on the trafficking conspiracy when it makes a bid to save the lives of Andrew Chan and Miran Sugerman. Mr. Myers became involved in the case after receiving a phone call from his friend Lee Rush. He called me one evening before Scott left Australia, with a concern that he had received a call to say Scott had an overseas ticket. And so I said, well, if you've got a concern, I'll call a friend of mine in the Federal Police. I knew a police officer who was on secondment, and that really started the whole thing. The AFP's liaison officer in Bali, Paul Hunniford, then wrote a 3-page letter to the Indonesian police. It said words to the effect of whatever action you see fit is quite all right with us, and it was an open invitation to the Indonesian authorities. So what actually happened here was that a concerned father spoke to a lawyer who spoke to the police, basically to help this kid, right? I mean, at the very least, to get him arrested back in Australia, to get him back to Australia. But what happened is, I mean, the father must be cursing himself now for ever having done this, trying to help his son. But what's actually happened is these people were, the AFP gave the Indonesians complete carte blanche, gave them all the information and actually encouraged them to arrest the Bali Nine in Bali, thereby putting them directly at risk of the death penalty, and they knew that. And that, my friends, is indicative of the complete carelessness, complete unconcern about human life, which it's just a reflection of the kind of the mode of society that we're currently in. It's a reflection of the callousness. So I'll play to you a little clip of a recent report from The World Today that summarises the whole situation on this topic. Here we go.
One of the lawyers involved in the Bali Nine drug case says the Abbott government should cite the role of the Australian Federal Police in providing intelligence on the trafficking conspiracy when making a bid to save the lives of Andrew Chain and Muriyan Sukumaran. The pair are set to face the firing squad this year after a decision by the Indonesian government to go ahead with executing all 64 death row drug traffickers. Brisbane lawyer Robert Myers told Peter Lloyd that the Australian police should never have cooperated with their Indonesian counterparts, knowing that death sentences could be imposed.
Peter, my initial involvement was simply being a friend of Lee Rush's, Scott's dad, and he called me one evening before the boys, particularly before Scott left Australia, with a concern that he'd received a call to say Scott had an overseas ticket, he had a passport. And so I said, well, look, if you've got a concern, I'll call a friend of mine in the Federal Police, and I knew a Queensland police officer who was on secondment. And that really started the entire thing.
Reprise for me again the role of the Federal Police there. The officer, Paul Hunniford, the AFP's liaison officer in Bali, he wrote a 3-page letter to the Indonesian police. Tell us what happened then.
It really said words to the effect of whatever action you see fit to take is quite all right with us. And it seemed to be an open-ended invitation to the Indonesian authorities that if they wanted to take it beyond surveillance, if they even wanted to arrest these people, even wanted to charge them, even wanted to subject them to Indonesian law, that the Australians weren't going to have any problem with that.
Just going to break, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking a little about the case of the Bali Nine, two men who are currently on death row, and the role of the Australian Federal Police in breaching our human rights responsibilities. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Herewood Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today. Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'll just continue playing here this clip from The World Today, the report on the Bali Nine and the lawyer, Mr. Frank Myers, who was a friend of the father of one of the, sorry, Robert Myers, friend of one, the father of one of the Bali Nine. So I'll just continue playing here that clip in that interview.
In what way do you think that that situation back then can help mitigate and help assist in the plea for clemency or the plea to save the lives of Chan and Sukumara now, so many years later?
I suspect it might be their only hope now because, as I understand it, the Foreign Minister and the Prime Minister have appealed to Indonesia. It sounds as though the appeals have fallen on deaf ears. It just struck me as though if the government... if the Prime Minister could say on behalf of the Australian government, we find ourselves in a terribly embarrassing situation because this should never have happened in the first place. I know that had our police asked for the cooperation of the Indonesian authorities, that they would have given cooperation, they would have kept these boys and the girl under observation, they would have reported when they were leaving Indonesia, and we could have handled the whole thing in Australia. And if there's an appeal made on a personal matter, on a personal basis, you'd hope that the President of Indonesia might say, look, I can see you're in an embarrassing situation where our countries are allies, we're good friends, we depend upon each other a lot, and we'd hate to see that the Australian government was terribly embarrassed by really a very bad error, a gross error, on behalf of the AFP, which was completely contrary to its own restrictions and guidelines. There is no doubt that the Attorney General would have to personally approve a cooperation between foreign entities that could result in the death of Australian citizens. And there was no doubt that by allowing the Indonesians to really have carte blanche in relation to the Bali Nine, that all of the Bali Nine were being exposed to the death penalty. Given personal authority for it.
So where does the buck stop in the AFP about the decision to hand them over?
I don't know at what level it was taken. I can't say that, Kelty was obviously the officer in charge of the entire show at the time. I don't even know if this decision was made by Kelty, but one would have thought it... the buck would have stopped. Well, the buck stops at the Attorney General, and my understanding is the Attorney General knew nothing about it. I can't say that Kelty didn't know, but even if he did know, he personally, I wouldn't have thought, had the authority to do it. He'd have to go to the attorney. But I don't even know that he took the decision. I think it could have been taken at a lower level.
Do you think that in the time that's passed since the offences back in 2005, people have forgotten about this aspect of the case?
I would have thought so. I wouldn't be surprised if the President of Indonesia doesn't even know about that aspect of the case.
That's lawyer Robert Myers speaking.
All right, so that's... summary of that particular aspect of the case. Now, there is another side to this, a darker side, which is somewhat conspiratorial in nature, and I don't want to strongly put it to you that this is what occurred, but let's just run through the basic scenario. And this has been discussed on some other sites, and you'll find it on expendable.tv. At the time of the arrest of the Bali Nine, there was another Australian who was very much in the spotlight of news, who was in prison in Bali, and her name was Chappelle Corby. Now, of course, that's a name that is well familiar to our listeners, and we've done many shows on the unjust conviction of Chappelle Corby. The connection between Chappelle Corby and the Bali Nine is something that I haven't actually previously talked about on this show. And what's important to consider here is it's very important to look at the timeline and the dates of the two cases, because Chappelle Corby was convicted. Her first conviction, in the first trial she went to, she was convicted on the 27th of May 2005 for the importation of 4.2 kilograms of cannabis into Bali. 27th of May 2005. Now, the Bali Nine were arrested in Bali on the 17th of April 2005, a good month before the final verdict was handed down in Chappelle's trial. Bear in mind that the actions that the AFP took, as the man in the previous interview said, were completely against their own guidelines. I mean, it was a breach of their normal procedure. And you have to ask yourself, why would they do that? Why would they bother going to the trouble of practically inviting the Indonesians to arrest these people? I mean, you could say, well, they're just callous, they don't care. Yeah, but normally, you know, they like to make the bust in Australia. That's what they do. If people are importing drugs into Australia, right, I mean, in virtually every case, if they have intel on it, they do the bust when the people arrive in Australia. And then they get the kudos for making the bust in Australia. It's more high profile for them. There's all kinds of reasons, even egotistical reasons, for why they prefer to make the busts in Australia. So if they deviate from that, there must have been a reason. Well, we know that the government in Australia, and we know that the AFP in particular, was in possession of a lot of information that showed that there was a corrupt network of baggage handlers operating within Australia that were being used to shovel drugs around the country. And the AFP also knew that Chappelle Corby's boogie board bag, which had gone from Brisbane to Sydney and then on to Denpasar, Bali, had not been scanned as per airport regulatory procedure, as per standard protocols that were actually enshrined in law at the time. The AFP knew all that. And the Indonesians had received information to that effect as well, because this has been part of the case that Chappelle had been defending herself, was the accusation that she was simply the victim of an airport smuggling network who used her bag. But of course the Indonesians weren't going to be persuaded by that and didn't really care about that argument. They were going to convict her regardless. Even though she brought a witness to testify on her behalf, who was actually transported to Australia from prison, and despite a lot of circumstantial evidence having come forward, including the internal report of the Customs Department, the Indonesians were going to crucify this lady because, for political reasons. I mean, they were going to do it to teach Australia a lesson. They were going to do it because Australia wasn't being the least bit transparent about what was going on. And they wanted to nail somebody to the wall. And they didn't particularly care if they got the wrong person. You know, the legal system there, it's not any better than ours. You know, it's full of corruption. And they were happy to nail her to the wall. Now, the conspiratorial theory that I'm going to put forward to you is that the Bali Nine were kind of offered to the Indonesians as a trade. That by arresting them and by allowing the Indonesians to arrest them and keep them, they were perhaps hoping that they would influence the court to let Chappelle off the hook. Because Chappelle was causing a good deal of embarrassment to Australia. And had she been let off the hook, that would have cleared all that up very, very quickly. So I know this is a complex theory I'm putting forward to you. And I will return to that when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And don't forget, folks, to check out the website and think about becoming a subscriber if you've got a bit of spare cash. The talk at the moment is the Australian economy is doing okay. Plunging Australian dollar apparently means more jobs and more household income available, although it does mean the prices of certain commodities go up. But if all of that leads to you feeling that you've got a little bit more cash to spare, why not spare it on Truth News Radio? I mean, we could really use it. I really, really do need the subscriptions, and I'm committed to doing this show every week. And it really requires the support of listeners to continue. I've actually had some quite severe dents to my own income streams over the last few months, and I'm possibly going to have to go back to working full-time, which is going to impact on the quality of the show. So anyway, I just thought I'd leave that with you at your discretion. Let's return now to the topic of Schapelle Corby and the connection to the Bali Nine. So, the dates. I mean, just keep those dates in mind because they're very important. The conviction of Schapelle Corby on the 27th of May, the arrest of the Bali Nine on the 17th of April. Now, a lot of things happened in that month. And it was in that month that public opinion suddenly was turned against Schapelle Corby, largely as a result of some really scurrilous articles which were published in Australia's mainstream rags. One of them, the most notorious of which, alleged that it was very common for tourists in Bali to buy Australian hydroponic marijuana. They had a special name for it, Bali Gold or something. They basically alleged that that this was very common, that people were smuggling this from Australia to Bali, and it was very popular with surfies and tourists. Now, that article has never had a shred of substantiation. It's never held up. It appears to have been just created for journalistic, propagandistic purposes to make people doubt the innocence of Schapelle Corby. Now, why is this important? Well, you know, this all happened shortly after the arrest of the Bali Nine as well. It all happened within the same month. And within the same month, the internal report of the Customs Department, it may have been actually a little later, but it was around the same time that the internal report of the Customs that proved that there was indeed a drug smuggling operation going on in Australia. I'm not quite sure when it hit the public, but you know, it was government was well aware of it, put it that way, up to that point. Mick Keelty was well aware of it. He'd been directly informed of it, and Mick Keelty again came up in the interview you heard earlier, because it was Mick Keelty who would have signed off. He would have had the authority to sign off on the Bali Nine being arrested in Bali. Now, Mick Keelty, of course, had gone on television news stating that he had no idea that there was any drug smuggling going on in Australian airports. You know, he said there's nothing to suggest that's going on, when he knew that there was actually a very hard evidence. You know, it was proven that it was happening. So he lied, and of course his lie completely foiled the hopes of Schapelle Corby. But the conspiratorial theory that I'm putting forward here is that the Bali Nine were thrown to the Indonesians as an exchange option. And it's not totally implausible to think that may have occurred, because they probably would have liked to get Schapelle back. Not saying they cared deeply about her. I mean, they were willing to just let her rot in prison. But the fact that she was causing such a problem meant that It probably would have been better for them at that point if the decision had gone in her favour. But it became clear that the Indonesians were not going to do that. They were not swayed by any of the arguments. The decision, the guilty verdict, would have been known in advance by Australia, by people in the government. And I believe a different strategy took shape at that point. And instead of trying to get her out, they actually tried to make sure that she stayed in. It's like, well, we can't get her out, so we're going to just turn the public against her to completely negate and undermine and invalidate her whole defence case, which had been causing a big stir, had been causing a big problem. So you could see it as a different strategy. You know, one strategy was to defuse it all by getting an innocent verdict out and get that quashed in the media. Another approach was to just discredit her to the nth degree, and that's indeed what they did. They discredited her, she was convicted, and then her appeal was also rejected. Years later, more and more information came forward, and if anyone's very interested in studying this further, please go to expendable.info, I believe it is. I'll put all the notes on the website, and you can go to the Expendable website where you can find all that information. Now, I have no idea whether there is this direct connection between the Bali Nine. The dates are certainly very, very indicative of something going on. The breach of protocol of what the AFP did still beggars an explanation. There's no explanation for it. So it's a suggestion for you to consider. Anyway, time to move on. We're going to consider now another very important and very clouded topic. The topic of David Hicks. Okay, I have an article here from ABC News. The US government agrees a former Guantanamo Bay detainee is innocent, according to lawyer. And I'm just going to play to you a clip from ABC News on that very topic. Here we go.
The stigma of being labelled a terrorist will soon be lifted from the shoulders of David Hicks, the Australian convicted for supporting terrorists and held in the US-run Guantanamo Bay detention camp for 6 years. After a lengthy challenge, the US government has finally conceded that Hicks was innocent of any offence in the American legal system. It's a personal vindication for David Hicks and a politically awkward turnaround for the Abbott government, which has always maintained the position that David Hicks was a dangerous man who belonged in prison. Peter Lloyd is speaking to Mr. Hicks' lawyer, Adelaide-based Stephen Kenny.
This is the first time the government and David's case have admitted that his conviction is invalid. The only thing they're doing now is really fighting a rearguard action, claiming that David entered into a plea agreement not to appeal his conviction, and so the court shouldn't hear it. I think it's very much a face-saving proposition by the United States government. Otherwise, they would have to roll over completely, and they don't want to be seen to be doing that. Because if the underlying conviction is completely invalid, as the higher courts have previously ruled, then, of course, any agreement he entered into is null and void.
So since 2001, essentially, David Hicks's name has been synonymous with accusations of terrorism. Now the Americans are saying that that's not true. How do you explain that to Australians who have always assumed that there was a just process here?
Well, I think what they need to do is look at what the American government did with the support of the Australian government, I might add, and that is they took people so that they were beyond the law, so that the law did not apply to them, so there was no due process, no rights to lawyers, no phone call home, nothing. And that's effectively how they were treated by those in Guantanamo Bay. And we've now seen the disastrous results of Guantanamo Bay and just how unjust that was. And I think Australians should understand that the Howard government were supporting something that no democratic country ever should. David,
we're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back talking about the David Hicks story. Don't go away.
in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking about the startling new information here that former Guantanamo Bay inmate David Hicks, who was ultimately convicted and actually served some of his sentence back in Australia under a plea bargain deal, is going to be completely exonerated of all charges. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary development and comes at an odd time, you know, when, of course, public opinion is now so heavily skewed against Islam that I think a lot of people aren't even going to recognise the importance of this. A lot of people aren't going to give him, aren't going to reverse their opinion of him, aren't going to give him any credit because he's a Muslim. I mean, Islam itself now is considered to be practically criminal. It's like the masses now have been brainwashed to such an extent that there is just a hatred and distrust of Muslims. And so the decision now with David Hicks, which would have been quite momentous a few years ago, even a couple of years ago, now it'll probably just be largely lost. Everyone will just forget it. And they'll say, oh, well, he was a Muslim anyway, you know. And he was supporting these people. You know, he should have been convicted. That's probably the meme that will go forth. But let me just continue with the just finish off the interview here with ABC Radio.
Of course, is very pleased with the filing of the United States government. He knows that this really is the home run for him in terms of clearing his name. That now most of the major hurdles have been overcome, and we expect that the court will rule in his favour. So he is very pleased.
How is it he's not guilty of something when he was on the wrong side of the war?
Well, it depends which side you pick on. Just because you happen to be on the wrong side of a war doesn't make you guilty of something automatically. And in this case, when David was in Afghanistan, he was certainly there at the time the Taliban were there, and he was associated with the Taliban. They were the government of the country. So there are many Australians involved with the governments of other countries. The issue is when Australians go overseas to attempt to overturn a government, then they run into some serious problems, as they should.
Stephen Kenny, the Adelaide-based lawyer for David Hicks, he was speaking to Peter Lloyd.
So there we have it, folks. So David Hicks was, of course, associated with the government of that country, which was overthrown by a foreign invasion. And isn't it interesting, you know, in the light of recent changes to the law that we've seen, where it's become new laws have been passed to prevent people from going overseas to engage in toppling governments. Gee, you know, well, what happened in Afghanistan? Well, actually, that was our government. We sent men in uniforms over there to overthrow the government by force. Oh, yeah. We're actually, you know, our government actually committed what would be considered a crime if it were done by an individual. I mean, we went into another country and overthrew the government. And it was a country that had not attacked us. It certainly hadn't attacked Australia. Of course, you know, claims were made that the Taliban had given shelter to the Al-Qaeda hijackers who flew into the Twin Towers, but there was never anything like courtroom proof that that occurred, just blurry videos that were held up and someone said, oh, look at this video we found. Oh, look, there's a guy that's looks a bit like Osama bin Laden saying something. I mean, that was literally how it was done. I mean, this was 14 years ago now, 13 years ago. Our governments acted like rapacious, barbaric, tyrant, pillaging empires of the past. And we now live with the heritage of that. We live with that as part of the fabric of our society. Our children have grown up with that. Yeah. A kid who was 5 or 6 years old at that time is now an adult. That's his whole life, that he's learned that this is the way the world now works. And as for David Hicks, well, you know, he was thrown to the dogs, just as Chappelle Corby was thrown to the dogs. And it was convenient to have a white man there. It illustrated the evil of what they were fighting a little more. They like to have the token white man that they can say is part of this. And it also is part of the ongoing demonization of dissent from within our society. And people said, oh, you know, David Hicks, you know, he's just a traitor, you know, a traitor. There was no concern about him. There was no concern for his rights. And now all these years later, we find out that indeed he was wrongly convicted. But this news story, folks, will just disappear beneath the waves very, very quickly. So that's why I'm raising it up in this show, and hopefully you can talk about it with your friends. I mean, we're seeing an obscene resurgence of American propaganda at the moment. The most, you know, grotesque example of which is this latest Clint Eastwood movie, which I have not seen, but I've read enough about it. I really don't need to see it. I probably will eventually. I'll probably be forced to see it. But this film is purely a somewhat desperate, crude attempt for the Americans just to try and regain that high ground of people believing that they are actually, that they have actually been fighting for something important. I want to play to you an interview that was conducted on RT by Abby Martin. It's just actually a really nice little summary, and it'll take us out to the end of the first hour today. So I'll just play to you this interview here of Abby Martin with independent journalist Rania Kulik about the Clint Eastwood propaganda piece on on the Iraq War called American Sniper.
Over the weekend, Clint Eastwood's latest film, American Sniper, smashed box office records as the highest grossing film that ever opened in the month of January. But a film glorifying a Marine who killed at least 160 Iraqis has not come without controversy. Joining me now to break it all down is journalist Rania Kulik, who's been following all of this incredibly. Thank you so much for coming on, Rania.
Thanks for having me on.
So can you first briefly explain who Chris Kyle is and why Clint Eastwood decided to make a movie about him?
So Chris Kyle's actually a Navy SEAL, or was a Navy SEAL, and he wrote a book called American Sniper that ended up being a bestseller. He got a lot of attention for it, and so they made it into a movie. Warner Brothers made it into a movie, and Clint Eastwood is the director, and Clint Eastwood has made several war movies. So this was just kind of like a new one, but this one was surprisingly, I mean, it was very in-your-face propaganda.
Right. Well, that's what was so funny, and thank you for correcting me. I said he was a Marine. He's a SEAL. When I saw the trailer in the movie theater, I actually laughed out loud because it looked like it was just perpetuating this myth of the human shield. The entire trailer was this human shield kind of imagery that's been invoked from Iraq to Palestine. I mean, did you get that sense? You watched it. I feel bad for you. You had to watch the movie.
I mean, so the movie is actually, I mean, it's a good movie in the sense that it's very well produced. If you are just completely ignorant about the Iraq War, then it seems like a great movie, right? But yeah, it's, I mean, there is like a couple moments where there's children around and there is a sort of human shield type, type thing going on. But I would say it's actually a little bit worse because what the movie does is almost every single child or woman in the movie, or every Iraqi for that matter, is a terrorist. who's like trying to kill U.S. soldiers. And the really creepy part of it is it's almost like it elevates Marines to this level, this like status of civilian, where they're like helpless, and Chris Kyle's this godlike figure who has to snipe people down to save him. And then these children or women who like take up arms against the occupier are just portrayed as like irrational, violent savages, as well as the men. In fact, the only, you know, the only time that women and children are victims or innocent is when they're being abused by really scary Arab men. I mean, there's one scene where a child is killed with a drill to the head by a man called the Butcher, who's like trying to teach his father a lesson for being a collaborator with the Americans.
You know, I wanted to read an excerpt from Chris Kyle's book, because when you started posting these, that's when I think things really started to get real here, because when you really realize what a psychopath this guy is, this is just one excerpt. I mean, he says, "My shot saved several Americans whose lives were clearly worth more than this woman's twisted soul. I can stand before God with a clear conscience about doing my job, but I truly, deeply hated the evil that this woman possessed. I hate it to this day. Savage, despicable evil. That's what we were fighting in Iraq." I mean, of course, the movie portrays him as this kind of tortured soul. What other examples of blatant sociopathy did you uncover in his memoir?
So, yeah, he calls them savages throughout his book. Another thing that he does is very openly in the beginning says, he loved what he was doing. He loved killing people because they were all savages. They deserved to die. He says the only regret he has is that he only wishes he had killed more. And, I mean, there's other things, too. Like, he says that if he could, he'd kill everybody who was holding a Quran. And there's one part that it makes you giggle, because he actually says that he believes that the reason that people are trying to kill American soldiers is because the American soldiers aren't Muslim.
My brain's about to explode. Yeah. I mean, and he even has a passage there about beating animals so hard his hand breaks. I mean, great guy. Great job, dude. But, you know, what's amazing is this all comes back to kind of his ignorance and his just, like, tunnel vision of why they're even there. I mean, zero context the film gave him.
Okay, I'm going to have to leave it there. Just as a side note, a lot of people won't be aware of this, but Chris Kyle was shot and killed by a 25-year-old U.S. Marine Corps veteran, Eddie Ray Ruth, whom Kyle had reportedly taken to a gun rage in an effort to help him with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I suspect there's a lot more to that, and I haven't really heard much discussion on the true facts behind Chris Kyle's death. But we are at the end of hour one. We're coming back in hour two with my guest, Dr. Vera Scheibner, to talk about Cherie Tenpenny and vaccines. Really important hour two. Stay with us.